Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, what can Blaise Pascal teach us right now? Ken, we've talked about Blaise Pascal on this podcast before, but Dave, you in particular have been engaging with some people who disagree with the Christian faith, and I think you've even read a book by an atheist, so that kind of prompted this discussion on Blaise Pascal, because Ken, you would say that Pascal has something to offer those who don't believe in the Christ of the scriptures.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In these two shows that I hope to do back to back, Joe, few years ago after my book, Classic Christian Thinkers, came out, I just jotted down right off the top of my head 25 things that I think I can learn from Pascal. And then in the next show, we'll do another thinker. And what I was really doing in that situation is, you know, I try to use my social media as hopefully a place of engaging apologetics and evangelism. But I also try to use it as a tool for education. And so I put those 25 down there for Pascal, and people enjoyed it. And I thought what we could do is I'll let you and Dave kind of pick some of those ideas, and we'll talk about them. I think Blaise Pascal is one of the most engaging Christian thinkers in all of history. I think very highly of him, and I think our listeners will enjoy this.
Great, looking forward to it. Ken, just for the sake of those who might be new to this podcast or have not read your book yet, Classic Christian Thinkers, which we highly recommend, can you give us just some brief bio information on Blaise Pascal?
Yeah, Blaise Pascal is born in 1623 and he dies in 1662. Lives a very short life, 39 years. He developed something like stomach cancer and died prematurely. But I can't believe the things this individual accomplished. He was born, of course, right at the time of the science revolution. In fact, Pascal became one of the founding fathers of science. He was a physicist. He was a logician. He was a philosopher of science, a mathematician, and in his early life, really all of his life was pretty early, but in his early life, he developed a calculating machine. Pascal was the son, Pascal's father worked for the French government. And his father was in the treasury department, so they had to stay up late calculating taxes and all these kinds of things. And Pascal said, look, if a clock could count the hours, I should be able to create a machine that will help us calculate, sums. And lo and behold, he created a calculating machine, which many people in technology, even today, they say that it was the first step toward the computer. So he was really a Renaissance individual, kind of grew up in a nominal Catholic family, but had an extraordinary conversion to Christianity. So Pascal has been called the first modern man. And I think he writes about things that would be very helpful and meaningful to people who are skeptical as well as Christians. So that's kind of a little summary of his extraordinary life. I can't tell you how much reading Pascal has meant to me.
Ooh, great. Well, thank you for that. Dave, I guess we can go ahead and go back and forth on some of these points that Ken has provided, and Ken, you will comment on each of these and help us to use these. The theme, I guess, as you said, is Pascal speaks to us today, and we can use these to help those of us who are engaging with skeptics and so on. And Dave, I'm sure you'll want to bring up your current situation, but I'll go ahead and go ahead, Dave.
Well, I as already mentioned, I am in the process of reading a book on atheism and engaging a friend who's an atheist. And one of the topics that comes up is this thing that is quite, Pascal is famous for, and that's called Pascal's Wager. So I would appreciate, Ken, if you could give us kind of an overview of what that wager is all about. And then we could maybe talk a little bit about some of the outcome or effects of that wager.
Yeah, I think, Dave, that probably this is the thing that most people relate to Blaise Pascal. And so let me just kind of summarize the idea, because I think, unfortunately, Dave, lots of people misunderstand it, including the author of the book you're reading by the particular atheist. Pascal was a leading scientific intellectual. And so he grew up knowing all the key people in France, and he had lots of friends who were intellectual scholars, scientists, philosophers. There's even a story that Pascal bumped into René Descartes. And Descartes kind of commented that Pascal was maybe too smart for his britches. But, you know, in France at the time, there were really kind of two positions that people fell into. They were either Christian and particularly Catholic, because France is largely a Catholic country, although John Calvin was born in France. So, you know, Protestants have also come from that country. So Pascal's idea, Dave, was that you got, on one side, you got kind of committed Catholics who are dedicated to the Christian faith. And then on the other side, you've got the atheists. But Pascal kept running into people, scientists, thinkers, and they were agnostic. They were skeptical. They didn't fit either in the religious camp or the anti-religious camp. And so Pascal was always the kind of person who was trying to provoke people to think and to reflect. And what he thought about a lot of these individuals is that they just kind of had given up on examining the big questions of life. So he created an argument for these types of people in his book, The Pensées, which is French for thoughts or reflection. Pascal develops the wager argument. And by the way, there are stories that Pascal in his pre-Christian life would gamble a lot, and he always won. And people were like, what's going on here? Why is this guy, you know, collecting all the money? Well, he developed probability theories and developed mathematical theories. So Pascal developed this this engaging kind of shot across the bow, if you will. He said, you know, let's consider what could possibly happen to us in death. In fact, I think he meant by the wager a cost-benefit analysis. He said, you know, something's going to happen to us in death. It could be the non-existence. It could be atheism is true. But it could also be that we survive the death of the body. And since God is one of the big questions of life, and since the vast majority of people, including intellectuals, has always taken God's existence as common sense, Pascal essentially said, you know, if we look at the cost-benefit analysis, you really can only win ultimately by believing. Because if you die and believe in God, you'll be rewarded with eternal life. If you die and not believe in God, you gain nothing. But by disbelieving, you can lose everything. And so he essentially came to the conclusion that believing in God was a way of winning the jackpot. Disbelieving in God would mean that you would suffer hell. And so Pascal did not say or imply that you don't lose anything by disbelieving, but he thought the prudent wager was to believe. Now, we need a little context for the argument, Dave, because I think a lot of people take it out of context. In fact, I've never heard anybody on social media or the web ever get it right. So here is some of the context for it. Pascal never intended the wager to function as a rational proof for God's existence, nor as a substitute for Christian evidences. He believes in the resurrection. He believes in prophecy. He believes in the existence of the Christian church. So he has evidence. It's not a standalone. Secondly, he aimed the wager at a specific audience, namely those who have opted to suspend judgment on ultimate issues. So he never intended this for the hardcore atheist. This was intended to try to provoke people to think a little bit. Number three, the wager emerged in a specific historical and epistemological context. This is what Father Copleston in his series on philosophy called rational skeptical thought. And then fourth, Pascal never intended the wager as a device. He intended the wager as a device to help awaken people who are indifferent to ultimate issues, including God, death, and immortality. I like what Tom Morris says. Tom Morris is a Christian philosopher, wrote a really interesting book about Pascal. He says that Pascal, again, attended this as a cost-benefit analysis. Probability theory, I mean, the whole idea of what could potentially await us. So that's, Dave, that's the context for Pascal's wager. I don't use it as a, I never use it as a standalone argument, but I would use it with people who maybe have never given some thought to what's at stake, what's possibly at stake in all of this.
One of the comments of the atheist friend, not the friend, but the writer, is that he thinks he loses everything. His response is, what have we got to lose? Intellectual integrity, self-esteem, a passionate, rewarding life or starts. In short, everything that makes life worth living. And my thought when I read that was, I wonder how that's working out for him. Does he really have all of those benefits when he chooses to disbelieve in God? Does he really have a fulfilling life? I remember us talking a few weeks ago on this broadcast about happiness and what is the source of happiness. And I'm not sure that all the claims that this guy is making really leads to happiness.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, Dave, that I think what Pascal would say is, look, I'm not asking you to believe in something you can't believe in. I'm not suggesting you believe a lie. I think the context of Pascal is, look, given the evidence for Christianity, for the persuasiveness of the person of Jesus that appears in the Gospels, the fact that Christianity emerged into history from a historical event, I think what Pascal would say, look, there's evidence to be examined. But in light of those evidence, would you like to give some consideration to what might happen? And Pascal never said you would lose nothing. But he's kind of looking at the big picture. What do you potentially have to gain? What do you potentially have to lose? I think a point I would make, Dave, is... it's a point I've made many times on this broadcast, and it's this. I think to understand another person's worldview or another person's belief system, you really have to look into it. You have to endeavor. And what I often find is that many atheists, including the new atheists, you know, Hitchens and Dawkins and Harris and Dan Dennett, that often they have a superficial understanding of Christianity. Now, of course, I'll turn that around and say, when I write books, I endeavor to try to understand what these other people are saying. But I'm not sure I've ever heard anybody get Pascal's wager within the proper context. So it encourages all of us to try to understand other people. And that's not easy. I mean, one of my favorite intellectual people of the 20th century, Mortimer J. Adler, he says, you know, you have to listen to other people. So that's kind of the summary on the wager.
Yeah, I have a question for clarification. Dave, what did the guy say he would lose again? What were the things that he was going to give up?
Well, you know, he felt by, you know, following the urging of this particular viewpoint, that he loses his intellectual integrity, his self-esteem, a passionate, rewarding life, everything that makes life worth living.
Now, that sounds like a Christian saying that. That's my comment there. Ken, what do you say about that?
Yeah, I think both you and Dave have touched on something, and that is, what does the naturalistic worldview offer people? Does it really offer them? Does it offer them a rational life? I mean, where did he get that intellectual integrity? I think there are things that naturalism really struggles to explain. One of them is the meaning and purpose in life. I mean, if the world is purposeless, if the world in which we live and human beings are the product of blind mechanistic natural processes, I'm not sure there's any ultimate meaning to life. Moreover, I'm not sure there's any objective morality. There's no life after death. So things like morality, meaning, and rationality are difficult to have. I'm not sure that atheist has what he thinks he has from his given worldview.
I would, you know, his first two, intellectual integrity, self-esteem, I think those, if he were really believing what he thought was a lie in order to take advantage of this wager, then he would be losing his integrity and his self-esteem, because he would, as you point out, this isn't meant to stand alone as an argument for God. It's meant to be in the context of having other sources of evidence and information.
Yeah, this is kind of pre-evangelism. You know, what are the stakes? You know, I mean, I think about, you know, my 401k. What's my cost benefit analysis? Should I put more into my retirement? Should I save other money? I think that's the context we should think of Pascal's wager. And it is true that Pascal, again, remember, he's got these people who are kind of on the fence. They're not believers. They're not deep disbelievers. They're kind of, you know, they've stopped trying to think about ultimate issues. And I think what, you know, Pascal said, look, why don't you come to church? I know you're, you know, you're noncommittal, but why don't you go to church? Or why don't you just pick up the Bible and read it and see what you think? And Pascal had the idea that you better be careful about doing things that Christians do, because you may then become a Christian. And so the idea was, this was given to a particular crowd. And you know what? I know people like that. I know people. These are not people who write books to try to disprove religion, but they're kind of like, you know, I'm just kind of trying to have fun in my life. Why do I have to think about these deep issues? Now, I will give you an area where I think maybe there is a reason why people misunderstand the wager. And part of it is because Pascal died before he completed his book. So when you pick up the Pensées, you get fragments, you get notes, you get ideas, but they're not fully fleshed out. What I would say is that if you want to critique the wager, look into people like Tom Morris, like Peter Kraft, like Doug Grutheis, or even pick up my book, Classic Christian Thinkers.
Yeah. Well, plus it seems to me that, as you said, Ken, this book is intended for, I mean, not book, the wager is not intended the way this atheist author is portraying it. he himself, Dave, has written a book, so he's interested in these issues. But Ken, as you're explaining, we have a lot of people in the West today that are busy pursuing their lives and can't be bothered with Christianity. They might think it's not for them. It's just kind of a whatever type of thing. So they'll take their chances, so to speak. Maybe the wager would help awaken them to these things, but that atheist author is already interested in these kinds of issues, it seems to me.
Yeah, I'll give you a quote from another thinker who liked Pascal, and that's C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis said that to be an atheist, you have to believe that the vast majority of humanity was wrong about the topic that they thought was the most important in life. So, you know, to be an atheist, you have to think, well, Plato was wrong, Aristotle was wrong, Augustine was wrong, Thomas Aquinas was wrong, Descartes was wrong, all the way down the line. Now, maybe they all are. I mean, maybe the atheists are a lot smarter than the theists. But I do think that there's a lethargy, if you will, a lethargic attitude about spiritual things. I know for me, it took the death of my brother for me to wake up and say, what is life all about? Of course, I have a question for the atheist that Dave's been reading, and that is, you know, if there's no God and religion is silly and false, why are you spending so much time with it? Why don't you go out and just live your good life? Could I suggest that maybe a lot of unbelievers can't let go of it because the Apostle Paul is right, that God has made himself known deep within us, or as what Calvin called the sensus divinitatis, all of us have an awareness of God. Now, I'm psychoanalyzing, but I'm psychoanalyzing in light of Scripture.
Of course, he would argue that the reason he's giving it the attention he is that he's trying to enlighten people to throw off all of this superstition and think straight.
Well, and I think that's not a bad comment, but in the end, if the world is meaningless and purposeless, what is that even a noble goal? How do you ground truth? Mm-hmm. So from an atheist point of view, isn't it all nihilism? I mean, these are questions we could ask.
Yeah.
Ken, can you articulate the wager once more for us? And then I have another question on Pascal.
Yeah. So again, the idea and the context is Pascal has these skeptical friends who are neither for religion or against it. And so he kind of develops this cost-benefit analysis by saying something's going to happen in death. It could be you go to non-existence and there's no life after death, but there is the possibility that there is life after death. Now, how would you stand to gain or lose? And he essentially argues you stand to gain everything by believing. Now, you may lose something by believing. Well, you know, I would be willing to bet $100 if I standed to win $1 trillion. I would think, well, yeah, I'm going to give up $100. That would be a nice dinner for my family at Sizzler. But, you know, am I willing to risk a little bit to get everything? What if I could win $1 trillion? I think Pascal is developing the idea that only by believing can you win the jackpot. You may lose some things. There's no doubt about it. But you also stand to lose everything by disbelieving. Now, you may gain something by disbelieving. Maybe you get more freedom. Maybe you get more hedonism, autonomy. But the ultimate loss, and I think that cost-benefit analysis, I'm willing to risk a little bit to get everything. So well, I think that's the context of it.
Yeah, yeah. I think
thanks for that.
The atheist response is, of course, that he doesn't believe that there's a God, that there's an afterlife. And he doesn't believe the evidence at least the atheists of today. And so he would say that there's nothing to be gained by believing in something that he doesn't think is true, but he loses his, you know, integrity. He loses his ability to live his life the way that he chooses to live it.
But again, Pascal never meant it for that person who's not willing to look at any of the evidence, who has dismissed it all. And again, I would even say for a person like that, you have to believe that the vast majority of humanity was wrong about the thing they thought was the most important. So, you know, I think it's fair to say the vast majority of people in the world in previous century thought believing in God just made common sense. So Pascal's not reaching the hardcore atheist. He's trying to reach the agnostic, the skeptic, the person who's not willing to consider these kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for that, Ken. That's helpful. A related question. I think you would say that Pascal is also noted for his view of human beings, the enigma of humanity. I wonder if you might explain what that is and how that provides evidence for a Christian view of humanity.
Yeah, very good. I think that's a very important Pascalian theme. And in fact, I would say this, I think that's a lot more important than the wager. I think the wager has value, but I think the topic you've touched on is even more important. You know, Pascal, again, he was a mathematician and a logician. And he really kind of develops probability theory. I mean, Bayesian reasoning, this is the probability, it has its roots in Pascal. And I think Pascal was a very astute scientist. He understood explanatory power and scope. And when he looked at humanity, he said that, you can read this in the Pensées, he says, human beings are an enigma. They're a riddle. They're really hard to get your mind around. And he said the reason is that this enigma contained greatness and wretchedness. That is, human beings are able to do science. I mean, I'm always struck by these National Geographic programs where you have scientists way out in the ocean investing, I'm sure, millions of dollars. And they're trying to save these sharks from extinction. And I'm thinking in a world of survival of the fittest, human beings are really, we've kind of taken dominion over nature. Humans care about things that I don't see how the animals could ever care about. So Pascal says humans are in a different category. They're able to reason. They're able to do great things. And I would say Pascal was one of them, creating a calculating machine. He developed the syringe. He invented all kinds of practical tools. So I think he would say that the greatness of human beings seems to fit well with the image of God. And I think he would, I think if he were today, if we could interview him on Straight Thinking, which would be pretty cool. Mm. I think
speak French.
Well, that's right. We'd have to bring parlez-vous français. We'd have to get an interpreter to come in. And by the way, I mean, who are the French thinkers? Well, Descartes, Pascal, Calvin. That's a pretty impressive kind of group of individuals. But Joe, to address your question, I think the enigma is found, the greatness is human rationality, human achievement. The wretchedness on the part of human beings seems to fit well with our fallenness. So I think Pascal is using this as a abductive type of argument. What worldview or philosophy of life seems to have the best explanation of the biggest riddle of life, which is humanity? And I think Pascal would adopt an abductive approach and say that if Christianity can explain life's greatest riddle, that's a very good reason to believe that it's true. Mm-hmm. You know, my boss, Hugh Ross, has often said that he doesn't think naturalism can explain either the greatness or the wretchedness of humanity. And I think Pascal does a powerful job of kind of giving us an explanatory viewpoint of the human condition.
Great, thanks for that. All right, we have other things about Pascal. Dave, do you want to weigh in on, I don't know, the heart?
The you know, one of the statements apparently that he's made is that the heart has its reasons, which reasons knows nothing of. Again, this is a question that arises in the context of my reading in this atheist book, where the author is pushing reason as the only grounds upon which we can have know anything, and that you can't know anything via faith, for instance, that if it doesn't submit itself to reason, it's irrational and absurd and not worth considering. And yet here's a statement that seems to contradict that. Can you share some thoughts on that, Ken?
Yeah, I would say I think science works on faith. I know that shakes a lot of people up, but I think it's true. You have to believe in a real world. You have to believe in the validity of math and science. You have to adopt the idea that the world has a congruence. I think it was William Lane Craig who said that science is filled with unprovable assumptions. So I think the atheist there, I would ask, well, what grounds your reason? I mean, if you're the product of blind mechanistic natural processes, if there's no ultimate mind behind things, how do you know that you can ever be rational? Well, but let me develop this idea of the heart. Again, I can only tell you, I'm just so impressed with Pascal. Here he is, he's a scientist, he's kind of raised and taught within this kind of rationalistic context, and Pascal comes to the conclusion that a lot of times we arrive at the conclusion, not that's rational, but that we want to believe. He suggests that there's more going on when it comes to God or ultimate beliefs than purely rationality. And of course, I think he's exactly right. I mean, philosophers have talked about, you know, you can believe something based upon reason, or you can disbelieve something based upon irrationality, which is what, you know, this particular atheist is suggesting. But I think Pascal is getting at, with regard to the heart, is that there are non-rational factors. You know, intuition, a flash of insight. It could also be revelation. And I think there's a lot of truth in it. I think a lot of times we come to the position that we think is based upon reason, but we really come to it because that's what we prefer. I think Pascal would say that faith is deeper than that. That faith is kind of a deep-rooted intuition. And to be perfectly honest, I think Pascal knew more about reasoning than most atheists. I think Pascal, what he should have been is a rationalist, but he wasn't. In fact, Peter Kreiff says that Pascal knew the power of science, but also its impotence to make us wise, happy, and good. I think the thing that impresses me the most about Pascal is not his technology, his contributions to technology and to science. I think what impresses me most is his recognition of the limitations of science. So I think he's getting at things like intuition. I think he's talking about things like revelation when he talks about the human heart. And you know, there are studies even today that maybe we've overestimated the power of reason, a lot of times we follow the, you know, the inner desires of our heart, which from a Christian point of view are corrupted.
Yeah. Thanks. Let's take another one of his thoughts that I think will be helpful in today's context. Here's a statement: in a world of lies, one must love truth to discover it.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, that sounds like Pascal wrote that yesterday morning. I mean, I have to say, the thing that I love about Pascal, and it's the same thing that I like about other thinkers like Augustine and C.S. Lewis, whenever they write, I feel like they're talking about me. I think they know something about me, and I can relate to them. You know, Pascal lived at a time where he was living at a period in which there were changes in the world. He lived at a time where you're moving away from what we might call pre-modernism into modernism. He is in a scientific context, and so he realizes that people are questioning the values that have been part of the Christian civilization there in France and in Europe. And I think he's really getting at the idea that, when you deal with human beings and when you deal with the human context, if you want the truth, you have to dig for it. You have to really commit yourself to it. And I think relating that today, I mean, today, they're all over the place. There are discussions of, is this really true or is this falsity? I think what's interesting, Joe, is that from the 1600s down to now, I don't think human beings have changed any at all. And it's easy to believe in fake news. It's easy to be persuaded by yellow journalism. I think if you want the truth and you want to be a truth seeker, you have to be intense and you can't let other people fool you. And I'll tell you the person you have to be very careful not letting you fool you, and that's yourself. You have to be brutally honest. And I think that's Pascal's point of emphasis there.
Excellent. All right. Well, you want to take one or two more here since we're on a roll?
I would like to ask a question. You know, one of the things that is constantly thrown in the face of believers by unbelievers is that if you believe and you have faith, you can't do science. That, science is suddenly thrown out as a possible source of gaining knowledge and information. But I think Pascal would differ with that. Maybe you could talk on that one, Ken.
Yeah. I think it is very important to appreciate that Pascal lives at the time of the scientific revolution. So people in history had made contributions to science all the way back to, the Mesopotamians, back to the Greeks and the Romans. Even in Babylon 800, they developed algebra. But science really begins one time, and it begins in Christian Europe in the 1600s. And I think that what we see there, Dave, is Pascal recognizes that science is rooted in a worldview. I find it, I touch upon this in a manuscript that I'm working on right now. I remember being on a radio program up in Fresno, and I was debating a professor of evolution, and he said, "I have no beliefs. As a scientist, I don't believe anything. I just go by knowledge and truth." And I think that that's a very deep misunderstanding of science. Science has not validated math and logic. Math and logic are assumptions that we have adopted. They're necessary truths, universal truths. I think to do science, you have to believe that all of this order and regularity extends all the way through the universe. So some of those places you've never seen. And then the remarkable thing that you can develop mathematical, that math corresponds to reality. I mean, that's an amazing thing. So I think to do science, you have to accept assumptions. And again, it's wrong to think that these are discoveries. No, these are assumptions that you start with. Paul Davies, who I really appreciate as a, both as a physicist and as a thinker, you know, he's made the point that scientists have a lot of faith. They have faith in the assumptions that, that they begin with. And even if you adopt a multiverse, you know, many people would say that's just as much faith. So I think it's interesting that you can be a scientist and not really understand the intellectual process of science. Just like you can be a philosopher and struggle in any number of areas as well. So I think Pascal was a very good philosopher of science. And he never stated it. He overstated it.
Let me ask sort of a related question that you did just a moment ago touch on, but maybe you could expand a little bit. And that is that the atheist scientist would argue that, say, for instance, mathematics is not an assumption that it works, but as you said, or you used the word, it's a discovery. And what they mean by that is that we have, you know, by using math over periods of time, discovered that mathematics can be used to predict the outcome of various physical experiments, or understand, for instance, the Earth going around the sun, or various things like this, understand gravity. So that they would say that they aren't starting out with the assumption that math works, but they are basing it on the fact that after years and years of fiddling around, they have discovered that math in fact works. And then they continue on that basis. Now, how do you counter that?
Well, but I think the mistake is to think that that somehow grounds mathematics. I mean, if math is built into the nature of the universe, that's a presupposition. And by carrying out experiments and you begin to recognize, hey, mathematics is like a language that we can utilize to use in science, that doesn't justify it. All you're giving is kind of a secondhand confirmation that it works. The question is, what worldview has the best explanation for how the human mind, the physical world, and mathematics are all networked together? I don't see how that could possibly be true in naturalism. I know it couldn't be true in pantheistic monism, but a worldview where humans, the human mind, the human brain, the physical material world, and the realm of mathematics are all brought together in a networked fashion. I think scientists have gotten so used to the idea that math works, they don't ask the question, but why does it work? Why should we have any confidence that it would work? If this all comes from, I mean, if the Big Bang has vomited up all that there is, where do we get these universal ideas that make reason and rationality so significant? I think that Paul Davies and even Albert Einstein are asking the deeper questions. The most, you know, incomprehensible thing about the universe that is that it's comprehensible. So it's not, Dave, doing experiments that show the reliability of mathematics are merely confirmation that that's true. It doesn't ground it. We don't know where the laws of logic or mathematics come from. The Christian worldview says they flow from the mind of God.
I think this argument that you're making here is especially powerful in asking the question, why do we believe in reason? Yeah. Why do we believe that the mind is capable of understanding all of these things, and that we can trust the outcome of our reasoning when reason and the mind supposedly came from a chaotic, purposeless process, namely the process of evolution. And I think, you know, these other areas also, I think, are attacked on the same grounds. But reason, I think, is particularly vulnerable to this kind of an idea. And the common response of the atheist, well, reason works. Yeah, it works all right, but why does it work is the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think that that's the case. And if the naturalist is right, that there's no mind behind the universe, then did reason come from non-reason? Did mind come from non-mind? Did design come from non-design? I think it's true that science has taken for granted that these kinds of things are true. But again, I think Paul Davies is right. To do science, you have to begin with kind of a theological worldview.
Yeah, great stuff. Ken, I don't know if you want to take one more or leave it there.
Let's tackle maybe one or two more. Let's see.
Okay, yeah. We're talking about how Pascal speaks to us today, some of his thoughts and ways to think about the world and how they can help you engage skeptics in your life. Here's one. The question of God's existence and the truth of the Christian religion cannot be decided by a mere appeal to reason. Uh-oh, Ken, are we in trouble there?
Well, I think the way of understanding that idea is again, Pascal thinks that our most fundamental beliefs run deeper than just mere intellectual data. Hmm. He's appealing to things like intuition. He is appealing to that persuasion runs very, very deep. So he's not belittling reason. He's not rejecting reason, but he is saying that for someone to come to believe in God, that God has to do something in that process, that God's grace has to reach into that person's heart and move them. So again, Pascal is a Christian after all, and he's an Augustinian Christian. So he believes deeply in the idea of grace and God's call in a person's life. So he doesn't think a conversion to Christ is a purely rational process. It's not irrational, but it's not solely rational. It involves need those kinds of things.
Would this idea be consistent with, say, Romans chapter 1, where people have an intuitive awareness of God already?
I think so. I think clearly so. I think Pascal is saying that maybe the reason that human beings is awfully autonomous, and again, I think Pascal is knowledgeable enough to realize that sometimes we come to the conclusions we want to. I'll give you an example of this. I took a personality test the other night, and the questions were given kind of in a range. You know, this is strongly true of you, or it's, you know, strongly not true of you. And then there are kind of the middle options. It's somewhat true. And one of the points that was made in taking this personality test is you need to be really honest. Don't say what you'd like to be true of you. Say what, you know, you honestly think is true of you. And I thought, wow, that is so important, because, you know, when I took the personality test, I had a lot of strengths, but I also had weaknesses. There's a side of me would like to hide the weaknesses and only emphasize the strengths. But the personality test, I have to be honest. I have to be vulnerable. I have to admit that there are things about me that I'm not comfortable with. I think Pascal understood that. And I don't think he would allow even in an era that emphasized science, to overstate the importance of science and reason. Mm-hmm. And that's really kind of an amazing that Pascal would be that kind of person.
Wow. I'd like to change the subject slightly. Apparently you have made the point that Pascal believes that religious experience is real and life-changing. We live in an era when people demean and minimize experience. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, Pascal had a major conversion. He was in his early 30s. Remember, he comes from a nominal Catholic background. And he's hotshot. He's wealthy. He's got a lot going for him. He's one of the leading intellectual thinkers of the age. Again, his father was pretty wealthy. He lost his mom early in life. That was a real blow. He had a couple sisters. One of them became a nun. But he's walking across, he's crossing the Seine River there in France. And he has a religious experience. It turns him upside down. Calls it the Night of Fire. He says that whatever he saw or whatever he experienced gave him utter certainty. I think this experience was, by the way, very similar to Thomas Aquinas. That Pascal and Aquinas, after they had their kind of mystical religious experience, they both said, I cannot rationally explain any of this. I cannot, anything I might say or write would never give you the real depth of wonder and beauty that I've discovered in my experience with God. Now, you know, some people say, well, after that experience, he gave up on science. That's not true. He remained a scientist, but he had an experience that was so meaningful to him, Dave, that he, even though he didn't talk about it, he had a little statement of it written, sewn into his clothing. And he had something like a vision of Jesus. And again, if I could allude to Pascal and Aquinas together, I think both of them realized that the reality of God transcends any human ability to explain it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why we should necessarily ridicule religious experience. I mean, if God exists and Jesus is the Son of God, why couldn't that experience be veridical? Why couldn't it be true? I mean, it's true, there are religious people who do kooky things, but there are atheists who do kooky things. And you know what's interesting? My three favorite guys, Augustine, Pascal, and Lewis, all of them had extraordinary conversions that really changed them.
Great stuff. All right. Well, thanks for that, Ken. Pascal certainly speaks to us today. But I got to tell you, if I ever go to Vegas, not that I'm hankering to go, I think I'd like to take Pascal with me.
he'd be a good betting partner.
All right. You've written about him, of course, as you mentioned. We recommend the book Classic Christian Thinkers. We're going to talk about another one of those thinkers, C.S. Lewis, next week, and how he can help us to engage those in our lives who have not adopted the Christian faith. So thank you for those comments, Ken. Be sure to check out Ken's blog, reflectionsbyken.wordpress.com. You will enjoy more material there as well. Let us know your comments and questions. You can reach Ken this way at RTB_KSamples. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, and Spotify. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.